Okay. Now it gives me great pleasure to introduce our second 30-minute speaker, Erica.
Hi, my name's Erica. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Erica.
I think it's so funny that when Jennifer said she picked her sponsor because she smoked American Spirit cigarettes and because she laughed at people a lot, it reminded me that my first sponsor, I had never met her. I got two phone numbers while I was in rehab of two different ladies that were recommended. I called one who said she lived somewhere else half the year and that wouldn't work, and I called the other one and she said yes, she would sponsor me. And a lot of you know Peggy, and she was my first sponsor. It didn't matter. I needed direction, and I trusted. I knew that I didn't have the answers anymore. I needed to trust someone else. And when Peggy moved, then I asked Jennifer to be my sponsor, and that's because at that point, now I knew enough to know that I wanted what she had, and that's how I chose her as my sponsor the second time. But anyway, so I'll tell you a little bit what it was like for me. It's interesting. I also am the youngest. My brother and sister are 11 and 12 years older than I am. I had a very happy childhood as far as I can remember, most of the time. I was basically an only child from the time I was 8 when brother and sister were gone to college. And, you know, I was a tomboy. I dug, built forts with my friends, the boys in the neighborhood. I played, had a lot of fun. Alcohol was a part of our family, but not to excess. My grandmother, when I was 4 or 5 years old, used to make a little homemade eggnog thing in the morning for us kids when my brother and sister would go to school, and I would stay with her, and she'd put a little, froth up an egg and milk and coffee and put a little nutmeg on it, and we'd dunk our toast in that, and on a really cold morning, she'd put a shot of brandy or whiskey in there to warm us up, and that was just a normal thing. It didn't cause me to want to drink every day at the age of 4. My dad would take me clamming with him out at Pismo when I was about 8 or 9, and that way he could go out on the sandbar and get 2 limits of clams, and I would just stand on the shore with my pitchfork, and when we'd come in, he'd give me a shot of scotch, or he called it Sand Dune Cutty Sark or something like that, to warm me up, and that was just normal. He had a couple highballs in the evening when he came home, and a glass of wine for dinner. And it was just, that's just the way it was. It wasn't an alcoholic home at all. I got drunk the first time. My parents had gone to a Royal Grande to a party, and children were invited. And I hooked up with the other kids at this party, and some of the older kids got all the leftover booze and went up on, it was kind of a landing on top of a bungalow of their property, and we made a suicide punch. And I remember drinking that and loving getting drunk. I felt like I was with the big kids, and it was really great. And on the way home, in the car with my parents, I was throwing up out the window, and my mom's going, "Oh, poor thing. I wonder what she ate that made her so sick." And I remember hearing my dad mumble, "It's not what she ate, it's what she drank." And so he knew. And I probably reeked, but the thing for me was they let me sleep in the next day. It was Easter Sunday the next morning, and they didn't make me get up and go to church. They let me sleep in. When they came back, my mom came in and checked on me, and I was okay. I remember thinking they knew, but they never said anything. And in my head, it was like, okay, I can do this again, but next time I need to be more careful that my parents don't find out, because I didn't like disappointing them. I felt bad about disappointing them, but I knew I was going to drink again. And it's not like I started drinking every day after that, but what I did do was when, about eighth grade or right around there, freshman in high school, when girlfriends would come over, we'd sneak booze out of the liquor cabinet. And by high school, I realized that, being popular was very important to me, and drinking was a part of being popular. And part of that was that I could drink a lot and usually was the last person standing. So I was definitely the designated drunk driver most of the time because I was still able to function when most people were dropping like flies. And, you know, it was that way through high school, and when I left to go to college in San Diego, you know, I realize now, and I didn't find this out until I got here, but what motivated a lot of my drinking and using was my insecurity and wanting to fit in and wanting to be popular. And I discovered really quickly when I was in San Diego that if I had the stuff, people would come to me and I would have friends. And so I made it a point to have the stuff. And, you know, alcohol was always a part of it, but boy, I was getting magic mushrooms shipped in from Florida and vacuum sealed bags, and we're skating down the boardwalk in San Diego selling mushrooms as high as a kite. And I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I drank alcohol the whole entire time, but I did other things as well. And this is how crazy I became. I managed to somehow stay in school, get fairly good grades, but what would happen was every time I would finish, like I got my my first AA, and then I set out, and then when it looked like, okay, now the real work is going to start, I'd change my major, I'd change my mind. Oh no, now I'm going to go do this at this other junior college because this is... because that won't interfere with my partying so much. And I wasn't even consciously aware of this at the time, but this was my pattern when I look back at it. As soon as it looked like it was going to be a lot of work, that I was going to have to buckle down and work, I would change my direction so that I could keep drinking and using the way I was. You know, most of the friends that I had made along this way, they're graduating and going on, and I just changed directions and stayed in school. Pretty soon, I find myself hooked up with this ex-con who, I mean, that seemed like pretty exciting for a while. I drove the getaway car while he would break into cars. It got really crazy. I had to hold a gun pointed at my front door, ready to fire if someone knocked on it. I mean, the types of people that I was hanging out with at the time, it got really crazy. And I didn't really think there was anything wrong with it. I mean, it was just, you know, it was just the way it was. It was at that point that this guy, he and his buddy, what they used to do is they would wait for big drug deals to go down, and they would go to the house, and they would tape up the buyer and the seller and take the drugs and the money. And apparently, and I was, you know, at home with the getaway car. At some point in time, the way I understand it, things got really hot, and he needed to leave the country. So we took my tax return, bought one-way tickets to Puerto Rico, and this is what's so crazy is that I thought, you know, this was just this Bonnie and Clyde life that I was going to live, and it was perfectly fun and fine. It was exciting, and it seemed okay. We got to Puerto Rico, and after about a week and a half, he disappeared. He ditched me there. So I go, okay, well, that's fine. I knew that I had some friends from San Diego living on St. Thomas Island, so I found a pilot with a plane to take me to the other side of the island to get to St. Thomas, and didn't know, I just started asking around, found my friends in St. Thomas, and slept on their couch for a couple days until I found a job. And what I didn't realize was that Greg, one of the friends, had called my parents in the meantime and said, we don't know what she's doing here, but she is insane. So by the time I called my parents to ask for some money to get me by until I got my first paycheck, they said, no, we'll give you a plane ticket home, and that's all we'll give you. And so I went to the airport, tried to cash in the ticket. They thought of that. So I got on the plane, and I came back to Santa Maria with 64 cents in my pocket. And and then I started going to school again, because boy, I was going to be something. I was a really high functioning alcoholic, I guess. Well, yes, I was. And so, you know, it just, the insanity just continued. And I managed to get jobs, I managed to get married, I had a couple of kids, and about the time my first daughter was, my daughter was born, I realized that drugs were a problem and I needed to stop doing drugs. So I quit. I didn't know anything about NA, I didn't know about detox, I just knew that I was only sleeping about 2 hours a day and that needed to stop, that wasn't responsible. So I laid on the couch and I slept for a week and I never picked up drugs again because I knew I had this addictive personality and that was going to be dangerous. But I never stopped drinking because that was socially acceptable. So fast forward through a fairly abusive marriage, I managed to, you know, I managed to accumulate all the stuff. We had, you know, the big house, the cars, the boats, the motorhomes, the, you know, the kids were in soccer and baseball, went to church every Sunday, and still, but partying, drinking, camping always meant alcohol. Alcohol was always a part of it. Eventually it got to the point where I realized that I couldn't commit to showing up to my daughter's bake sale on Saturday because I wasn't sure if I was going to be too hungover or if I was going to be drunk already. And things started, the dysfunction started intensifying. And of course, my husband pointed out that it was all my fault and that I needed to stop drinking. So I tried. I said, okay, I'll stop drinking. And I think at one point I made it for about 17 days. And that's probably, I probably fudged in there somewhere. But eventually what happened was I had to start hiding my alcohol, and I would hide little pints in the sweaters, and I became a closet drinker. Then I got busted for the bottles in the closet, so I started putting the vodka in my water bottles, because then you wouldn't know that I was drinking, and I could drink on the way home and then not drink while I was at home, and they wouldn't know, right? So one of these days, I had had my little drinks on the way home. My daughter comes in, the conversation's great, and all of a sudden, she says something that pisses me off or upsets me, and I run up the stairs, that's it, I'm going to kill myself. And we had a gun, and I knew where it was. I didn't know where the bullets were or really what to do with the bullets after I got them, if I got them. But my daughter called 911. So they came, and they took me, they 5150'd me, and I woke up in this, in a San Luis mental facility with these green walls and this big nurse named Sue. And it was really horrifying, and I wanted out of there bad. And these people, you know, when they talk about the paper slippers, you've heard Steve Counts talk about the paper slippers, there were people with the paper slippers there. It was really horrifying. So my husband calls and says, he will come get me if I promise to go to an AA meeting that day. And of course, I'd do anything to get out of there, so I agreed to go to an AA meeting. And that was December 14th, 2005, which is not my sobriety date, but it was my first AA meeting, and it was, even though I don't remember anything that was said, I do remember that I felt like there was some hope. There was some hope for me that maybe I could quit drinking. Prior to that, I knew, you know, I was beginning to understand that I had a problem with alcohol, but I didn't know that there was a way for me to stop. I had tried, and it hadn't worked. And this looked like it might work. So I dove right in. I read the book a couple of times. I could talk the talk. I was in meetings all the time. And I kind of made a failed attempt at the first three steps, but I wasn't being honest. I was a little different than y'all. I was a little smarter, and I was a little bit, I kind of figured, okay, I can kind of do this AA thing, but I want to do things my way. And so at about 5.5 months, because my husband, because he didn't have a problem, I found his bottle in the closet, and I took a swig off of it, and I thought, hey, check this out. I just had one drink, and I'm fine. See, I am not an alcoholic after all. and or I can control it. And of course, within a week or two, I was drinking just like I had before. So I spent the next year in and out of these rooms until finally I had tried, just like it says in chapter 3, I tried every experiment, every, you know, way to control and enjoy my drinking, and I couldn't come up with a way that was going to work. And while I still had all the material things, I hadn't lost any of that, the spirit within me was dead. I had no self-worth, no self-esteem. I was beat down, done. And it was at that point that that I went to a rehab in Santa Barbara, well, detox first and then a rehab, and became willing. And thank God for that desperation, and Jennifer talked about it, because I realized at that point that I didn't know anything. You know, here I thought I was so smart and I was, you know, so self-sufficient and I could do, you know, I could figure this thing out. At that point I realized I didn't know anything. I was even in an outpatient program once when they were talking about the physiology of alcoholism and how it actually, what triggers in the brain and all this, and I remember thinking, oh good, if I can just figure this out, then I'll know how, you know, I'll know about alcoholism and I'll know how to control it. That wasn't the case. For me, I had to have that desperation, and I had to know that I knew nothing. And you know, I had a God in my life because I was going to church, even though I was drinking vodka on the way out of the parking lot. But I had put a wall up between me and God, because if I got too close to God, I wasn't going to be able to drink the way I wanted to drink. And so I had to, at that point, I had to start inviting God back into my life. And it was just a daily prayer, you know, for me to just, God, come be a part of my life. Let me be willing to be willing. And it took weeks and months for that spirit to start to, for that flame to start to ignite again, because it was like out within me. And when I got out of rehab, I met with that first sponsor and I said, you know, I was desperate at that point. I said, I've done the first 3 steps in rehab. If you want me to do them over again, I will. But I really want to get onto that 4th step, because I hadn't done it the first time. And I knew, I felt like I need to do these steps in order for things to be different. So she was willing to let me do that, and I started working the steps, and she also made me get involved. She also made me be of service. I remember one time she told me, when you go to that meeting tomorrow, I want you to get the name of a newcomer, and I want you to call her. And I thought, oh, good Lord, that's awkward. And so, but I, you know, I was willing to do whatever she asked me to do. And I did that. And and I remember being in the Costco parking lot and calling this lady and saying, hi, this is Erica. I just called to see how your day's going. And so we had this little chit-chat, and it wasn't much more than that, but you know what it did? Next time I saw that lady in a meeting, we had a little bit of a connection that I didn't have with some of the other people, because we'd had this little phone conversation. And those were the little tricky things that she would do to get me plugged into this fellowship and get me to be a part of this group. And, you know, getting service commitments is washing coffee cups. This is about all I could do for a while. And What I realized through working the steps is that, you know, well, God started showing off for me well before I was even done working the steps. But when the change really started to happen was when I, and the promises started coming true, was when I had worked those steps and started giving back to others. And you know, I was just thinking about the desperation, the incomprehensible demoralization. You know, what's happening? Oh, it's too dark. Wow. Hi. You know, working the steps And staying involved, staying in the middle of the herd is what made the difference for me. I realized that I had to make my sobriety, my recovery, my number one priority, and everything else would work out. And that's what I was told, and that's what I had to believe, and that's what I had to do. When that first couple of years of sobriety, you know, I stayed with my husband for a year against some recommendations, but I stayed there for a year before the kids and I moved out, and it was difficult. But I remember when the kids and I moved out, my daughter coming to me and saying, you know, you were selfish when you were drinking, and now you're selfish now because you're always gone to these AA meetings. And I said, honey, you know, I could be at an AA meeting for 2 hours a day, or you could have me drunk all day long. You gotta pick, which would you rather have? And I had to make AA my priority, and it took a long time for those kids to be able to trust me again. And you know, it's really funny. You know, we think, okay, we get sober and everything should be fine, and then I can put a white picket fence around everything and everything's going to be rosy. It doesn't work that way. It takes a long time. It took me 30 years to get to the point that I was able to come into these rooms, and it was certainly going to take longer than, you know, a year or two for me to restore what I had destroyed. Today I have to say that one of the things that I recall, that I remember, is a demoralizing moment in my drinking was, this is while I was hiding it from my family. I remember being in the garage. It was on a hot day like this, and I got the bottle of vodka out of my Tahoe. I'm squatted down behind the Tahoe in my garage, guzzling hot vodka, and it's running down my throat, and I'm trying to get it in me before anybody comes out that garage door and finds me. And I think, and I remember thinking, this is really sad. This is really a sad picture right here. That's the picture that I keep in my head, that I keep at the forefront when I'm, you know, I'm 5-6 years sober and I'm sitting somewhere with a group of people that somebody's having a glass of wine and the little dewdrops coming down the glass and it looks so pretty and so fresh and the sun is setting over the ocean, and I think, oh, maybe I could just have a sip of that wine. No, that's the thought, the me behind the Tahoe with the hot vodka is what I have to remember, because I've never had a sip of wine. I've never had a glass of wine. I don't drink like that. I'm 0 to 60. I mean, I never drink socially. I only drink to get drunk. And so for me, I have to, even today, I have to remember that that I am an alcoholic. You know, I think that was the turning point for me, was when I got okay with that. You know, and when I finally accepted that I have this disease, it's not going away, but I'm okay with that, and I'm not embarrassed of it. It is what it is, and once I became okay with it, then I could start to live a good life through the help of this program and my higher power. Staying spiritually fit, it says in our book, that our recovery, our sobriety is contingent on our spiritual life. That the only way we're going to stay sober is if we continue to stay spiritually fit. And the only way I can remember to stay spiritually fit is when I keep coming to meetings. Because as soon as I stop coming to meetings, and it happens from time to time, I get busy, I don't get here very often, and as soon as I start not going to meetings, you know, really staying plugged in, my head, my alcoholic head will start telling me, oh, you don't need that, you don't need to pray today, you're too busy to pray, you know. I'll just start getting away from it, and as soon as that starts happening, I'm going to pick up a drink. And to me, right now, the way I feel is that I don't want to give up what I've gotten so far. I don't want to go back to that. I don't want to go back to that hot vodka behind the Tahoe. It just doesn't sound very good to me today. So I need to keep doing what I'm doing. And, you know, there's periods of time when, you know, I feel like I'm really growing spiritually, and there's other times when I feel like, you know what, I just kind of feel flat. Well, that's when I go back to basics. I start reading the book. I say my prayers every morning, every night. I call my sponsor. I talk to you guys. I remember what it's like, you know, what recovery is all about, the beauty of it, and that's what does it for me. And so I guess that's all I really have to say. So thank you.
Okay, let's give Jennifer and Erica a round of applause for sharing. And now we turn it over back to our secretary.
Okay, Billy, I'll call our secretary.